Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
Produced by the iLab at WBUR, Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. How have you gotten through your worst breakups? Tinder, new hobbies, cheap alcohol, putting your saddest music on infinite repeat? Well, Mark McDevitt writes about a friend who helped him get through a breakup in his essay, Misery Loves Fried Chicken Too. William Jackson Harper is back to read the piece. He stars in The Good Place on NBC. You can also see him in the new movie Midsommar this July.
Nate was my breakup buddy. We were introduced at Scruffy Murphy's Irish Bar by a mutual friend who thought we'd like each other. And I liked Nate instantly, with his tight crew cut and animated features. He seemed transplanted from another generation. You could easily imagine him as a bit player in a 50s war movie yelling out lines like, "Hey Sarge, over here, he's in a hole," or "They shot me, Ma, I'm bleeding." We hung out that summer evening in support of a favorite local band, but when our mutual friend left Florida for Boston and Nate started seeing a woman, our fledgling friendship stalled out. I was in a relationship then, too. She and I had been together for more than 2 years and even had begun to talk about marriage, which both excited and terrified us. We were approaching our 30s, so it seemed like the logical next step. And then it all unraveled rather suddenly, leaving me angry and bewildered. It was during this aftermath that I bumped into Nate again. At first, I didn't quite recognize him. In the years since I'd seen him, he'd packed on a good 20 pounds and grown a scruffy beard. Gone were the once animated features and zippy one-liners. Something about his hollowed-out stare and shell-shocked appearance told me his relationship hadn't worked out either. No surprise, then, that the place we ran into each other was the self-help section of Barnes & Noble. This time, our bonding was instantaneous and absolute, the kind shared between shipwreck survivors on a bobbing yellow life raft. While no model of mental health myself, I at least had a couple of months' head start on Nate. For him, only weeks after his breakup, the world was still a minefield of painful associative memories. A sudden whiff of jasmine or an innocent radio jingle would produce in him bouts of demented laughter or uncontrollable crying. Over the next couple of months, our friendship flourished. Favorite recipes for chili were exchanged, along with Patsy Cline records. We swapped our mini self-help books, which we referred to with titles like Men Are for Mars, Women Are for the Birds, and Cohabitating No More. I gave Nate the entire collector's edition of the Three Stooges. He gave me a cactus. "These prickly little bastards is some tough hombres," he explained. "Just like you and me. We may be in the desert right now, but I'm here to tell you that we'll get through this." Over time, our anger and despair gave way to confusion. Just what happened, anyway? Where did we go wrong? Like a crack team of FAA investigators, we scoured the crash sites of our respective disasters, looking for clues. Details and timelines were relentlessly hashed over. But the cause of Nate's mid-air explosion remained as mysterious to us as the forces that had caused my own relationship to belly flop into the Everglades like a jumbo jet with the wing sheared off. Our futile search for answers only deepened our depression. But the great thing about depression is that it's not one size fits all, but comes tailor-made to suit our particular personalities. For me, it's about insomnia, skewed priorities, and loss of interest. Food, work, correspondence, even the Three Stooges all lose their luster. The big picture fades as minor details assume gargantuan proportions. CDs will suddenly beckon to be rearranged from alphabetical to reverse chronological order and back again. I simply have no choice. The only real consolation is found in pop music. Leonard Cohen, Elvis Costello, The Smiths, a never-ending cycle of misery and heartache providing grist for our mill of self-pity. Pop music has the amazing ability to make you feel depressed and hopeful at the same time. Depressed that you identify with the sentiment and hopeful because someone feels more miserable than you. For me, that someone was Nate. The only brightness to my day was seeing my breakup buddy and feeling marginally better that he was even more depressed than I. He'd show up at my door carrying a family-sized bucket of chicken drumsticks. If I'd lost all interest in food, Nate had gone in the opposite direction. He gobbled up anything that wasn't fastened to the floor. Even so, he couldn't figure out his weight gain. "I just don't get it," he'd say, wolfing down his third cheeseburger. "I mean, where did it all come from? It's like you turn 30 and boom, you're a pumpkin." I suggested a little exercise. There were tennis courts near his apartment, and so it became our habit to play once or twice a week. Neither of us played well, but with a lot of sweating and grunting, it proved therapeutic. When I aggravated an old shoulder injury, our tennis came to an end. After that, I didn't hear from Nate for a couple of weeks, and I'd assumed he'd found another tennis partner or become busy at work. But when my phone calls and email messages went unanswered, I decided to drive over to his apartment and check up on him. His car was there, but the blinds were drawn. After I pounded on the door for a good 15 minutes, Nate finally poked his head outside, like a giant mastodon awakened from a thousand-year slumber. Something about his glassy-eyed stare and the greenish-orange hue of his skin told me he'd taken a turn for the worse. Walking into his darkened lair, I understood that Nate had not found another tennis partner. Instead, he had crossed over into Joseph Conrad territory. He'd journeyed up the Nang River into the heart of darkness. Without air conditioning, the apartment was a good 10 degrees hotter than the 90 degrees outside. The fetid hum of sweat, unwashed clothing, and rotting food hung heavy in the air. A chicken carcass lay on the kitchen floor, stripped to the bone as if by a piranha. Walking to open a window, I noticed there were vegetable peelings all over the floor. Nate appeared moments later from the kitchen, mechanically shaving a carrot. When he finished, he chomped on the carrot and started peeling another. "What's with the carrots?" I asked. "Ah, nothing," he said. "I just quit smoking." "And you took up carrots?" "Yeah, it gives me something to do with my hands." I filled three garbage bags with chicken bones and pizza boxes and took them out to the dumpster. Smack in the middle of the living room, directly in front of the television, was a shiny new bench press and giant barbell. Glossy brochures and bright plastic folders about how to become a real estate millionaire in 10 easy steps littered the floor. Gradually, a picture began to emerge of a man who hadn't slept or washed in days, spending his time alternately lifting weights, watching late-night infomercials, and eating fried chicken. Alarmed and anxious to get out of there, I suggested we go see a movie. He was game, and after stopping for 2 bags of carrots, we pulled into the theater. The movie of the summer was Castaway, starring Tom Hanks as Chuck Noland, a clever chap who washes ashore on a desert island after his plane goes down in the Pacific. As his hope of rescue fades, he begins the long battle for survival and, more important, his sanity. Something about the story spoke directly to Nate and me. While I don't think Castaway was intended as a comedy, we never laughed so hard in all our lives. It was like watching ourselves up there on screen. People in the audience glared disapprovingly as we laughed in all the wrong places. We howled when Chuck knocked out his tooth with an ice skate, while the rest of the audience sniffled as he selected the tree from which to hang himself. We clenched our sides with hilarity. Hopelessly isolated and lonely, Chuck develops a relationship with a volleyball, giving the ball a face, even a name, Wilson. It was Wilson, more than anything, that helped preserve his sanity, allowing him to mount a last desperate bid to escape his island prison. I thought about the strange set of circumstances and coincidences that had brought Nate and me together. I told myself he was fortunate to have me as a friend, and while keeping an eye on him had allowed me to feel charitable and magnanimous, I knew my impulse was anything but altruistic. In truth, Nate was the yardstick by which I measured my own progress, helping me to feel good about myself and preserve my own sanity. Nate, I realized, had become my Wilson. This overweight, slightly addled person munching carrots next to me was my life raft. When the movie ended, we shuffled outside with the rest of the Saturday night date crowd. Handsome boys and cultish girls dressed in shorts and t-shirts. They wandered outside laughing and smiling, blissfully unaware of the dangers they courted. Would they still be happy and smiling in a year's time, knowing, as we did, that to love is to risk great unhappiness? For them, the movie was over, forgotten like the 2 large buckets of popcorn left under their seats. For us, the movie clung like a lingering dream state. It followed us into the parking lot and beyond. After getting ice cream, Nate and I sat outside admiring the clear night sky, happy to have company, but each secretly wishing that he was somewhere else, with someone else. I couldn't even recognize it for the glorious time it was. 6 months later, I finally managed to escape my own desert island by moving to New York. And though I've since lost touch with Nate, I often think about him. When I do, it's not the grief of my horrible breakup I remember, but the laughter and friendship that followed. Don't believe me? Just ask Chuck Nolan. I'm sure he feels the same way about Wilson.
That's William Jackson Harper reading Mark McDevitt's essay, Misery Loves Fried Chicken Too. We'll hear more from Mark after the break. Mark McDevitt's essay was published in 2005. He says it's strange to reread the piece today.
This morning when I was coming in here, I thought, oh gosh, I better read the story again. You know, it's been 14 years. And I'm on the ferry coming here and I'm chuckling to myself, laughing. With the benefit of time and hindsight, I can look at it now with a kind of detachment. So I had a lot of compassion for that guy who's sort of confused and reeling. And then looking to this other person as a sort of a life raft and then glomming onto him in a way that is now very, very humorous to me. But at the time, you know, it felt like a drowning.
Mark never heard from Nate about the essay, and he's not sure if Nate's read it.
I didn't stick it under his nose, nor did I hide it. And we fell out of contact after we broke up. We didn't talk for many years and then reconnected via Facebook, as many people do. And we shared some very nice notes and memories. And then we kind of went our separate ways again.
And Mark thought Nate was a fascinating character.
One of the qualities that I liked about Nate was that he was an open book. You know, he was defenseless, in other words. And we all have our armor that we go into the world with, right? You know, look at me, I'm so together, I'm so polished. And he was just a mess. And he didn't disguise that. And it made me love him. I think what we're alluding to, or I'm alluding to, is depression and male depression. And different men will deal with that in different ways. And I think in his case, he stopped taking care of himself. And perhaps, you know, he might not like to be reminded of that. You know, the carrots or the, you know, forgetting to shower for days at a time. You know, that kind of thing. Some people don't want to remember that. And I understand that.
Mark got through his own breakup by getting deeply involved in his work and new life in New York City. And eventually, he met his wife through his uncle, who he says kept pestering Mark to call her.
I had no interest in meeting anybody, and certainly not anybody that my family was going to recommend to me. But it became such a nuisance, and he became such a pest that I was like, okay, fine, I'll meet her. And when we did meet, it was like, oh, okay, now I see. Now I see what he was trying to tell me.
But Mark says he was a little hesitant to take the risk of getting into a new relationship.
We just kind of took it slowly. At least I did. I took it very slowly. Maybe she would have liked that we got married quicker, but I'm Irish, you know. A 10-year engagement is not unusual.
So the breakup Mark writes about in his piece was his last. But he remembers clearly that when you're in the midst of a breakup, it can feel like there's not much that's worse.
The only advice I would say is don't isolate. There's a great tendency, at least there is for me, to draw down the curtains and crawl under the covers and listen to the Smiths, you know, and kind of go into the dark place. Sometimes it's by dint of will. You have to force yourself to get out the door. You're not even in the mood, but you just say, I'm doing this.
And he says it's important to remember that things will get better.
Eventually, you're going to move through that that period. You'll come out the other end. And you may even look on it with warm affection. Even in the misery of my breakup, you know, me and Nate, we had a good time. We were going through something, so it was very hard to see it for that in the moment. But I look at it now with great tenderness and fondness, especially for Nate.
Mark McDevitt. He's a writer and screenwriter living in New Jersey with his wife and son. More after the break. Here's Daniel Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times.
Modern Love, the column, may be mostly about romantic love and probably secondarily about family love and family bonds. But we do have, really interesting pieces about friendship. But in this case, I just loved their connection. I love the sense of humor about it. It was just a really funny and touching piece about how much friendship can really mean to you and get you through hard times.
And here's William Jackson Harper.
There's like a commiseration in misery. I know that, like, living in New York, for me, like, sometimes that's the thing that I miss the most, is that sometimes things just suck and you look at that other person across the train having that same sort of experience, like, yeah, this sucks. This all sucks. We're all in this together and it just sucks. And, like, there's that, which I find really comforting. And it's also, there's something about how depression sneaks up on you. When I've had my moments, it's like just a cloud. Like the way he describes his depression, just everything loses its luster and food doesn't matter. You can't sleep. It's just sort of, for me, it's not even like it's not an active like sadness. It's more just everything feels pointless. And sometimes in the midst of that, when you have a person that's also going through something that's similar, there's something about the relationships forged in those times which feel like they can be really lasting. It was just so specific and felt like, oh no, I've been that guy. I know that guy.
Thanks again to William for reading this week's piece. You can see him on NBC's The Good Place, which is back this fall. Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Caitlin O'Keefe. Original scoring and sound design by Matt Reed. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Special thanks to Samantha Hennig, Anya Stremian, and Mia Lee at The New York Times. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Additional music, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.